show a piece of the pie. Right here, right now. We want to show a piece of the pie. Right here, right now. We want to show a piece of the pie. Right here, right now. We want to show a piece of the pie. Right here, right now. They rob our fathers of their gold and try to take.
Jamaica's Jimmy Cliff with Piece of the Pie. It's from his 1983 album, The Power and the Glory. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we are taking a look at stories with something in common, a quest for justice. Our first stop is the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri, which today files a lawsuit against the Ferguson-Florissant School District and its at-large electoral system, saying that it dilutes the voting strength of African Americans in the district, and that is a violation of federal law. We have as our guest today the executive director of the ACLU of Missouri, Jeffrey Mittman. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with your listeners.
Thank you. Now, what is this motion? What is this action that you have taken in the court, and why?
It's about three things. One, at the most historic global level, it's about laying out in a court of law so that the court and the local community can understand there is, unfortunately, in our country, in our state, and here in the St. Louis metropolitan region, a history of governmental policies that have intentionally singled out the African-American community for unequal treatment, and that those historic policies have real consequences here and now today. And in order that we as community can come together and address those problems, acknowledge that history, and then move forward together, we have to have a clear record that we're all aware of. Two, immediately, it's about addressing the disparities in education there in the Ferguson-Florissant School District. African-American students don't do as well in tests, are differentially singled out for unfair treatment and discipline, are not allowed to have the same achievement or participation in the advanced placement courses. And those disparities need to be addressed. They need to be fixed. They need to have policies put in place to change them. And finally, the tool to make that happen, of course, is that families can participate in the process in choosing their elected representatives to create those policies. Right now, in Ferguson-Florissant School District, African Americans are essentially kept out of the electoral process. What they use is an at-large election system so that the white majority is able to choose their candidates and block out the representatives who are preferred by the African-American community. That's undemocratic, and it results in these poor outcomes.
Now, how is this trial proceeding? I mean, what has happened that led up to this?
So what has happened is a few things. One, we looked at the way the elections are held in the Ferguson-Florissant School District, and initially, when you see an at-large system where a majority of the school board candidates are predominantly white. Of the seven school board members, often there have been no African-Americans whatsoever. On occasion, there's one. Right now, there just happens to be two. Moreover, they're all from one concentrated geographic area. So you see a problem of one community being kept out of the process. Two, you also see racially coded language in how the elections occur so that the majority white community are preyed upon to exclude African Americans. Unfortunately, the Voting Rights Act exists so that when you have a history of time and again the white candidate is elected and the African American candidate is excluded, the Voting Rights Act says that is not permitted. So what we saw is a tool to address inequities, and more fundamentally, democracy, elections, participation of families in the electoral process, that's how we make change. That's how we know that each of us is part of the political process. So setting up for the court the history of the discriminatory policy and the actual outcomes of election after election proves to the court there's a problem that needs to be addressed, and then recommends potential ways to fix it.
Now, this action, how has it been reacted to or greeted by local authorities and the federal government?
Right. Well, one thing to be aware of is we are incredibly pleased and proud to have as our client the Missouri NAACP. As you know, the NAACP has many goals to address racial inequality, to ensure economic opportunity, educational opportunity, housing equality. So we are proud to represent Missouri NAACP and family members in the district who live there. We are pleased that the community is aware of this lawsuit and is happy to have an opportunity to address inequalities. Unfortunately, the school board has taken the opposite tack. They have claimed that the system is fine just as it is. An African-American community is getting the representation they want. Unfortunately, as we've seen from the first witness who testified, that's not the case. Other school districts are putting policies in place to address racial disparities in educational achievement. They're putting in place policies to address the disparities in school discipline. Unfortunately, Ferguson-Florissant has not done so. So their claim is really belied by the facts, by the results of the elections, and by the achievement of the students in the district.
Well, this action follows the ACLU of Missouri's other action, which is the Fair and Impartial Policing Act. It seems, since covering St. Louis and Ferguson in particular, it seems as if you have had nothing else to do in this rest of the state except concentrate on this area. What is it about this particular area that is so trenchantly resistant to fairness and justice? Could you explain the Fair and Impartial Policing Act that you also, in conjunction with many other elected officials and, of course, the NAACP that you mentioned before, have introduced? What is the need for this?
Absolutely. And, of course, as you know, while we are doing this work, of course, we're continuing to concentrate on church-state separation, on LGBT equality and women's equality. But as you noted, it is important to acknowledge that across the country, in the state of Missouri, and right here in the St. Louis metropolitan region, there is a significant problem. There is continuing racial inequalities. There are continuing policies that disadvantage the African-American community. For example, policing. Every year for the past 15 years, the Missouri Attorney General has issued reports that look at the numbers of African-American drivers who are stopped as opposed to white drivers, who look at the number of drivers who are searched and arrested. Year after year after year, the disparities are stunning and troubling. African Americans are in some cases almost twice as likely to be stopped, and in some places even more so. The problem is, every year those reports come out, and nothing is done to change it. So we are incredibly proud to have partnered with the Don't Shoot Coalition and to supported the work of Democratic Senator Jamila Nasheed and Republican Representative Ashamet Durbin. And they have introduced the Fair and Impartial Policing Act, which will do a few things. One, it says that where these statistics year after year are worse than even the bad state average, those municipalities must take steps. They must engage in training for their police. They must do enhanced monitoring, and they must seek to ensure that those disparities go down. By the same token, as this is a bipartisan bill, it also looks at the way those statistics are compared, residents in the community versus individuals driving through. But we see when there are disparities in courts, when there are unequal access to justice, when there are over-incarceration of the African-American community, when there are disparities in how the African-American community is policed, we must do whatever we can across a wide variety of social and economic policies, legal policies, to start to address them. So you're seeing us doing work on policing. You're seeing us doing work on courts. You're seeing us doing work on Voting Rights Act. And all of the community is coming together to say, one at a time, we must address these problems and we must find solutions that we can work on together to make a change.
Now, you were able to gather information in order to build a case on the basis of the at-large elections and on the basis of unfair policing in the city of Ferguson and in other towns and cities across Missouri. Why then has the Justice Department not been able to do the same thing? And why does it now take these legal actions to compel what the Justice Department and every elected official practically at the state and federal level claiming they're doing all they can to assure justice and equality?
Right. Well, I do want to acknowledge, for instance, the Department of Justice report on the Ferguson Police Department was a stunningly well-researched, well-profiled, well-written, and unfortunately disheartening document. It really focused very clearly and in a very thorough manner on the disparities in policing, the disparities in court treatment, and the unequal targeting of the African-American community, what we now commonly understand as the new Jim Crow. I think part of the problem may be that, unfortunately, this is not a situation that is unique to St. Louis or Missouri. This is a nationwide problem. And what we see is a gathering consensus of work by organizations such as the NAACP here in St. Louis, the Don't Shoot Coalition, ACLUs across the country, other advocacy organizations. When you look at the situation up at Mizzou, the students standing up and acknowledging and bringing to the attention of the wider majority community a history of disparate treatment at the university system. So I think what you're seeing, this is a systemic countrywide problem in communities across the country that requires community engagement. The ACLU is pleased to partner with other organizations, individuals, or students, with coalitions of advocacy organizations, and in some cases with the federal government. But the Department of Justice is doing their piece. Of course, we all wish all of us could do more, and I think perhaps with a different Congress that was able to provide more funding to these programs, we would see even more work by the Department of Justice. But this is not something that happened overnight. As was testified at a recent Ferguson Commission hearing, this is long-standing policies this country from our initial entry into this continent through the initial founding of the country, through slavery, the Civil War, the first Jim Crow and now the new Jim Crow. This has not happened overnight. This will not be solved overnight.
Well, I appreciate the delicacy with which you present your argument, but I believe that the Justice Department basically has done a service. Yes, I agree. It has done a service by putting together all these statistics and drawing the obvious conclusions. These conclusions, just the same, are not new. They have been told to people for decades. And finally, the Justice Department moves. And when it does move, it does not move with an eye toward prosecution of anybody. It moves administratively to encourage administrative changes. So do you think that there should be a point at which we see an elevation in the response, not just to recommend administrative changes or to do reports, but to move swiftly and raise these complaints to the level of criminality, since you suggest, and I agree, that this has been going on for decades, which is tantamount to intention to commit a crime, to deprive people of their rights. Does it frustrate you that we do not see this aspect of the Justice Department, since it is the nation's highest prosecutorial authority, to move swiftly and to move decisively to prosecute, especially in the situation where you have public officials abrogating their responsibilities and infringing on people's rights deliberately?
You know, it's a wonderful question, and let me address them this way. These are incredibly complex social issues, and sometimes, unfortunately, if the issues don't affect our immediate family, our immediate neighbors. Sometimes they are so difficult and so frightening and so frustrating that it's, I think, a normal human tendency to throw up their hands and say, well, we can't do anything about this. Now, of course, we know that's not true, but I think an approach that can be helpful is, can we bring forward information such as in this trial so that the majority community has an opportunity to learn about the history that you and I and your viewers are so well aware of, but for some reason they may not have attended to? Give you, for instance, in Cincinnati, back in 2000, there was a similar situation what we had with Ferguson and Mike Brown. There, what the community did is they came together, police chiefs, police unions, elected officials, the ACLU, community organizations, all came together and said, we can continue fighting, or we can come together and start talking to each other and find a collaborative solution. Sometimes, as opposed to the back and forth, the claim and counterclaim and the ongoing fight, which requires battle and political will and lawyers, sometimes it may be that telling a story and inviting people in to discuss and learn perhaps is a better way forward. So I don't want to say it's not necessary when there's criminal activity to prosecute it. I don't want to say that we can ignore and stop agitating and advocating for government to be more active, but I don't want to say that's the only role. I think as well, and one of the things we're trying to do here is to engage the community, to bring people together. We might not agree on everything, but perhaps we can start talking about this history that we're looking at and agree, minority and majority, progressive and conservative, all of us agree together, we must do something. We will be stronger as a region, as a city, as a country, if we start finding solutions.
Well, how do you predict this might go? The case against the school district, the trial that has begun, and the Fair and Impartial Policing Act that you have put on the table for legislators to consider?
Well, let me start with the latter. I am so pleased that this is a bipartisan bill. As your listeners may know, in state of Missouri, we have Republican supermajorities in both the House and the Senate. So it is important for bills to get a hearing, but they do have a Republican sponsor. And again, I want to congratulate Representative Schmidt Delgan, who stood up and was willing to introduce a bill like this. So the fact that it's a bipartisan bill, the fact that it's got good coverage, the fact that the legislators are paying attention, and there is an agreement as to 15 years of government data, I think bodes well that we can start to make progress. That being said, any political reporter would tell you they never, it's really just the first week of legislative session, they will never predict this early on how the legislative process will happen, but I can assure you that the community and the advocates will be pushing very hard for it. The same thing with the court trial. Today is the first day of the case. We believe that the law and the facts are on our side. We've done a very careful job presenting our case to the judge, who I think will be very careful in considering it, but again, I don't want to make predictions, but I think the history of the discrimination, this reason, the outcome of the elections, which speak for themselves, I think are very persuasive, and we hope will convince the judge to do the right thing.
I want to thank you very much, Jeffrey Mittman, for being with us today. Jeffrey Mittman of the ACLU of Missouri. And while you're on the air, so I can say this in your presence, I will say that the ACLU of Missouri has done so much, especially in recent months and in the aftermath of the Michael Brown killing by police, to really do the work that many, many lawyers should have been doing, especially the lawyers for the families affected. And I thank the ACLU for standing up and coming to the aid of so many people who desperately needed it at a very critical time. So thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you, and thank you for those kind words. Our team is very passionate, and we appreciate being able to make change here in our state.
Thank you. Well, we go next to Detroit, my favorite city, and favorite for a number of reasons, but mostly because people are just not laying down and letting the steamroller go over them. Today in the city of Detroit, about 60 public schools are closed. Our guest, Elena Herrada, who is a member of a school board, who has found herself in the strange position of being an elected member who has no power, along with the rest of the school board, because, well, we'll get into that when we start talking with her. Elena, why are the schools closed, so many schools closed in your city today?
Well, there are many schools closed. Actually, we don't even know the exact number yet because they're constantly reporting different numbers, but it's at least 60 schools that are closed, and they are closed because the teachers have been so under attack that they basically have been put in situations that the more teachers leave, the worse it is for the remaining teachers, and they can't do the most basic job of teaching anymore, especially with health care cuts and wage cuts and constant attacks on them. So they have several demands, which I will post for you later, but they're basically asking for their health care and their wages to be restored, for a reduction in class size, for there to be adequate resources for them being able to teach, and for their prep time to be restored. There are many more things that people don't really understand how long it's taken for teachers to stand up, because teachers are not the people who stand up. They're the people in the classroom. So for them to come to such a point is really, it means that it's extreme.
Could you give us an idea of how, in fact, they did come to this point? Give us some history and background on this.
Well, when the first emergency manager, Robert Bob, came in 2009 under Democratic Governor Granholm, Robert Bob took 10% of the teachers' salaries. And he just took it, basically just took it. And under emergency management, they've been able to terminate contracts, change health care without bargaining. They've been able to do all kinds of things. In emergency management, because it doesn't have any transparency, there's no, for example, elected school board to vet the contracts. It's an absolute recipe for corruption. So Robert Bob cut teachers' wages. They went to court and they won the right to get their 10% back, but for many of them, it wasn't until they retired or left the district. So they right away took a 10% hit. They already have working conditions that are much harder than most districts because the Detroit is so incredibly. Right. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. We temporarily lost our guest, as she is, in fact, running around in Detroit trying to get things under some degree of control to the extent that she can. And why it is important to talk with Elena Herrada is that there is a unique situation with the school board to which she was elected. It has no power. All of this is going on against the backdrop of the state. As you remember, we have been discussing the bankruptcy of Detroit for almost 2 years, and this is a direct outgrowth of that, exacerbated by the imposed bankruptcy on the city of Detroit. And one of the things that the state did was simply say, hey, guess what? Your local board has no power. We have an alternate system. Elena, you're back. Thanks so much. I am back. Thank you. I just want to point out in as brief a time as I can that
the system that's in place is put in place in order to be able to make a few people rich really fast at the expense of the poorest people. It's very easy to attack poor people and also have the most Title I money in the state. The big pot of money is in education. So Snyder and Duggan and friends have made it their business.
Just hold
to
us for a second. Snyder
schools.
Would be Governor Rick Snyder.
The Governor Rick Snyder, the write-in mayor, Mike Duggan, who many of us do not believe was elected. We witnessed and asked for a recount of the election of a white man who was not beloved by anybody here, was not beloved by Detroit, and who did not live in the city long enough to be on the ballot, therefore was written in. He received millions of dollars from Dan Gilbert of Quicken Loans, from all manner of wealthy investors. And it was under Duggan's watch that we went bankrupt because we were forced into the consent agreement. So Duggan and Snyder are here to loot the majority of the poorest people in Detroit and hand off their money to the richest people, and that's what has happened so far. The complicity of many other people involved is just simply what happens when there's people in power that people believe, you know, well, they're in charge. So the unions got involved with them. The NAACP got involved with them, the nonprofit community especially. The philanthropy has been essential in the takeover of Detroit Public School. I want to also say that because we are elected, we have no authority. We have no resources whatsoever. We don't even have a secretary. We have no resources. But yet, Snyder and Duggan want to remove us and replace us with their appointed board members.
Now,
why
this
would
is
they do
the
that?
School board that you are discussing, of which you are a member.
Right. There's 9 of us who are elected. I mean, I'm sorry. There's 11 elected board members. There are 7 of us who say we are in exile, but that's the majority, and we have fought back at every turn of every single takeover, every school closing. We have fought along with some dedicated parents and supporters. We have fought the complete takeover, and that's the reason that we even haven't been completely taken over by the nonprofit community, which is trying to basically remove us and replace us with their handpicked choices. Why would they want to go after people who do not receive a salary and who do not have any authority to let contracts make any decisions? Because we resist the attacks on public education in Detroit. And they want to replace us with people who do not resist and who they can remove if they did say anything. They haven't been able to do that to us, and that's their plan. And we are just now together meeting and making a strategy for what they do for when they do come for us. Because probably we will end up getting arrested. We may go to jail. We don't know what's going to happen. But we are not going to walk away from our elected positions without a major fight.
In all of this now comes the philosophy, because the city has been
right.
under emergency management for many years, since 1999, practically.
The school district. No, the district and the city are 2 different entities here.
Right.
We
so I'm saying in this climate, the philosophy of the governor is cut, 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 cut. How has the state, what has the state's position been, especially when bankruptcy was imposed?
Well, the state is, you know, enjoying quite a surplus now since it took everybody's money. There is a state surplus of money, and Snyder sent Darnell Early to be the emergency manager of Detroit Public Schools 1 year ago. We've had Darnell Early a year ago. So they've been hiding what happened in Flint with the water. They've been able to cover that up because they enjoy the complicity of the media. They enjoy the complicity of everybody who should have said anything and didn't. And now heads are rolling and people are getting fired. But under emergency management, which Flint is and every other black city in Detroit, in the state of Michigan, every city in Michigan that has black majority is under emergency management, which means that only Snyder, the governor, has decision-making power for every one of those businesses. Which means that he's solely responsible for everything that has happened on his watch, because none of these other people had any authority. They're trying to blame elected officials now, but they had no authority. So they sent us Darnell early a year ago. Now people are up in arms because it's very interesting, and I want to call out this contradiction in a way that is something that has I've made this observation for a lifetime. But water is considered really within the realm of an environmental sort of issue. Water is a human right, water, but education is not a human right. So the fact that there is emergency management over education hasn't bothered a lot of people. But the fact that water was poisoned, of course, is a very, very extreme human rights violation that affected babies, it affected old people. People have died who were not that sick. And so there's been incredible, incredible attention now to the ravages of emergency management in Michigan because of the pollution of the water, which General Motors wouldn't use for their cars, but the people had to drink with the support and encouragement of the state telling them that it was safe to drink. So we got the emergency manager over Detroit Public Schools, who was the same one who was over the water in Flint. So the fact that the schools have been under emergency management from 2009 to 2005, and then once again in, 99 to 2005. And then we voted to get our board back. We didn't have our board back for very long when the emergency manager came in, rendering the board powerless. So no black city in Michigan is allowed to govern itself because of either consent agreements, receivership, or emergency management, all of which are only the governor's control. So the fact that the water has been poisoned has brought a lot of attention to Michigan, and it's sort of a barometer, if you would sort of say, what does it take for white people to be enraged about the ravages committed against black people in the state of Michigan? What it took was for the water in Flint to be poisoned, because it didn't matter that every school district had been taken over. Places like Inkster, they actually tore down their buildings. Muskegon Heights, they closed all the schools and put in charters. The charter left because they weren't making enough money, and now there are no schools in Muskegon Heights. Every black city in Michigan is without education that it can govern. But the water was actually the thing that finally got the attention of the nation. So the water poisoning, for as horrible as it is actually the only thing that woke up the rest of the country to what was happening in Michigan. Educating children in ways that basically there's nonprofits around here that send books to Africa, and our libraries are closed here. Highland Park, Michigan doesn't even have a library. We have schools that have no libraries, we have schools that have no textbooks, and we got nonprofits that are sending books to Africa. We have $50 million restorative justice contract in a school that has no security guards, because the nonprofits decide what are the priorities of the school. The board doesn't get to say anything. So we don't get to say, no, this is not right. There shouldn't be 50 kids in a classroom. No, it's not right. You can't take away teachers' prep hours. We don't get any of that authority. Governor Snyder gets that authority, and he wants to hand it off to people who will have to basically do what he says. So everything that they're offering and changes right now is more of the same, but even more diffuse and more less transparency than what already exists. So the changes that are coming, there's going to have to be a revolt for voting rights for black Michigan. That's what's going to have to happen.
Elena, you've been in the world of activism for most of your adult life. What do you see as the game plan here?
Well, I never dreamed that we would see a resegregation, a state-sponsored institutional resegregation. I've actually been an activist from childhood because my parents and grandparents were also active and civic activists, So I've been here to watch desegregation, to watch these orders, and to watch it being dismantled and reinstituted as a policy to put the poorest black children into one school district called the Educational Achievement Authority and take away all the resources from that and just basically warehouse them to have 100 kindergartners in one classroom with one teacher and two aides. This is basically the state-sponsored reversal of all of the battles that were won by Rosa Parks, by all manner of civil rights activists. And this is actually being done in a much, much more insidious way, because it's being done by nonprofit organizations that hire young people to be organizers and come into the schools. Teach for America was one of them. White young people were replacing seasoned black teachers. Children don't see anybody that reflects them or their experience in these schools, and there's more and more and more of that. And I never dreamed that I would see busloads of young people coming basically to steal voting rights instead of the what we saw in SNCC and those other kinds of places. And they don't think they're doing it, and they don't think they're wrong. They think that, you know, they think it's a good thing to do, to work for the nonprofits and get into the schools and never mention, never think about the governing structure of Detroit Public Schools versus the governing structure of the schools that they went to. So it's a much more insidious kind of racism. It's very well-dressed and polite. It's not dogs and hoses. It's 501c3s.
What interest would the nonprofits have in taking this tact? Why would they set about a plan, a concerted effort, to essentially do exactly the opposite of what they say they're about?
Because nonprofits, you must remember, are banks in drag. Nonprofit organizations are philanthropic organizations that don't have to pay taxes, that don't have to answer to anyone, and can put in programs where they want. Banks have a different kind of interest. So the gentrification of Detroit, you know, the nonprofit community and the banks are behind the gentrification. So if you can render invisible or make black people and poor people move away, then they have the property that they got for dirt cheap. That was, you know, we're on the river. We're in a really valuable real estate market here. So Detroit is, you know, ground zero for gentrification. That's the interest that the nonprofits have. They're following the agenda of the banks.
You said even the charter schools made an attempt, but they too have failed. How come?
Yeah, the charter schools are a way of siphoning public money into private hands. So if you can, you know, get your hands on the money from charter schools, you're basically, charter schools are replacing crack houses for the new economy in Detroit. That's the, you know, charter schools were meant to make money, nothing else. The narrative of them was always very, very well-dressed of being an alternative to public education, because public education had been starved of its resources. So if you can starve anything out, anything coming along, it looks better. That's why people got into the drug trade, for the lack of any other kinds of resources. So charter schools are, you know, why aren't there charter schools in the white communities? Or why aren't the white communities dealing with having to have their public schools completely replaced by charter schools? Because their schools are funded. If our schools were funded, there wouldn't be all these charter schools. And Snyder also lifted the cap on the number of charter schools in Michigan, giving us the highest number outside of New Orleans, outside of Louisiana. We have the highest number of charter schools. And the distinction of for-profit and not-for-profit is a joke.
And we know that in Louisiana, there isn't a single public school left in New Orleans.
That's the plan for here. It's even the same people. Even the same people are bringing that plan. And when Robert Bob
impact on education that has been experienced in the last couple of years, what has happened to public schools? How many schools have been shut down in the city of Detroit?
More than half of our schools have been shut down in the city of Detroit. And I'll tell you something else that happens that wouldn't happen if we had an empowered school board. They take our real estate, the school buildings, and they hand it off to their friends. Prime real estate in a city that is supposedly bankrupt, in a district that's supposedly bankrupt, and give it to their friends. So billionaires get school buildings for free. Mike Ilitch from the Red Wings gets a new stadium that we built. We are building his stadium with tax dollars. He keeps all of the tax captures that was headed for education. He got all the property for free. This is what happens under emergency management. People who could govern themselves would never agree to that. But that's what Duggan and Snyder have hooked up for their friends. It's a free-for-all. It's like robber baron days here. And people think from the news, because the media thinks it's a wonderful idea. You know, the media doesn't get mad the way people get richer. So, there's just this idea that all of this development is good for Detroit. Well, Stadia, everybody knows that Stadia is not a sound development. And Illich knew it, so he wasn't going to pay for it for himself. He's already got two stadiums. So why would he pay for one? It's not a good investment. We pay for it for him. This is what's going on in Detroit. The vote means nothing here. Our votes don't mean anything.
How many schools have closed and how many students have been affected by the closures so far?
Well, I think I don't want to say how many schools have closed because I don't know the current number of that, and it would be depending on from what year to what year. I know that they said that with the 64 schools closed today that there was something like 67,000 students affected, but I'm not sure what the actual number is because 15 of our schools were taken out of Detroit Public Schools and put into the Educational Achievement Authority. So one of the things that has happened is there's charter schools, there's EAA, there's Detroit Public Schools, and then there's these other configurations called public charters, like Detroit Public School Charters, which are basically just a way to circumvent the union and circumvent seniority lists and pay scales. But when they do that, there's all these different configurations, so they don't know even what our graduation rate is. They don't know any, they can't track any information about these students because they have created all these different districts, which is basically carving them up and giving them to these different interests that are able to get to the table. What they're doing now is trying to combine them all, because that would be an economy of scale like a real school district has. So they're trying to combine them all, but the outstate areas, which are white, are saying no, they don't want to combine them because they have charter interests that don't want to be part of the accountability that would be evident, that would be inevitable if there was a one school district. So there's a big fight now, but it has nothing to do with education or children. It's more like rival gangs in the mix. So if we had 150 schools left, it would be a lot for the city, the size of the city that we have. But so many people have pulled their kids out, and so many charter schools in the suburbs send buses in to take our kids to their schools, and it's really, really sad. Little tiny kids being bused early in the morning to really inferior schools far outside their neighborhoods when they pass just dozens of neighborhood schools that are boarded up. It's really sad to watch that, but I'm telling you, it could not happen if it wasn't a black city. It couldn't happen. It would never happen in a white district because 55 districts are in worse financial shape than Detroit. None of them are under emergency management. You know why? Because they're white. So emergency management is only for black districts. And no one across the country is raising this issue.
Let me ask you, what is immediately ahead? The schools are shut down. The teachers are on a sick out. They've taken action because the situation has now reached a crisis point. On top of the schools already closed, 60 or perhaps more are closed today. What are you doing and other members of the board doing who are in for the fight? What is the fight? What's the timeline?
Well, we hear that the schools are going to be closed for the rest of this week, but nobody knows that. What's interesting about this sick out is that there isn't any one group doing it. What's very interesting about this is that there was a split in the union, in the Detroit Federation of Teachers, and one faction that had been in place for many years and it was completely complicit with everything the emergency manager was doing was voted out. A much more militant faction was voted in. Very shortly after that, the union trusteed the local and ousted the president that was elected. now that it's trusteed, there's just a complete vacuum of leadership within that union. Also remember that Right to Work came in last year, and come June, there will be no dues checkoff. Right now, we hear that half of the teachers in the union have stopped paying dues. And I don't think it's a combination of thinking that the union hasn't been able to do anything for them anyway. But with the wage cuts, it was pretty easy for people to take back 2 hours of pay that they were paying to union dues before that. So now the Michigan Federation of Teachers, which took over DFT, has less than half of the members that it had in Detroit teachers. So the fact that there's all these different entities battling over control of the schools, different entities battling over the way forward for teachers, is really, I think it puts us in a place where we probably were before there was labor laws, before there was a civil rights law, before there was desegregation. We're back in a place where there was nobody really in charge, and whoever is able to make the most sense to the most people is going to prevail in what's going to happen for the best way forward for the students. Governor Snyder should be in prison. I don't mean he should be not elected again. He should be in prison. He has violated rules of the Geneva Convention by poisoning people. The emergency manager law was voted out, but we have it anyway. So Michigan is sort of an example of what happens when nobody rises up and goes after this kind of tyranny. People are poisoned. Your votes are taken from you. Your school systems are taken over. Everything is privatized. We're back at a point where probably like the turn of the last century. So we know what happened there. Unions came into being. There was civil service came into being, and different laws were passed to make things more fair. We're basically in sort of a rerun mode, and it'll be very interesting to see where it goes. But historically, we've seen all of this before. We're just we're in a point of regression. So I would say that the more people wake up, the more is taken away, the better it is. And we'll just have to make our way this way. Nobody here has any answers to this. Anybody here who has any answers to this, I'm telling you, if they say they have any answers, they're delusional.
Well, this is the thing. People would say, you know, the situation couldn't possibly be that bad. You probably are exaggerating things. And yet I see that this is a kind of template for what's going to happen and what has been happening in other cities as well. You noted New Orleans. We know New Orleans no longer has a public school system at all. Right. Detroit is being emptied, and other cities, all of the predominantly black cities of Michigan are now under emergency management and going through the same kind of experience. So it must be that there's some kind of a plan here. These things could not possibly be just, you know, unrelated to each other.
No, not at all. Not at all. There's powerful forces against us, but we've been here before. I'm not saying this to, I'm saying this really free of a particular agenda or lens, if that's possible, to the extent that it's possible. And I have been an activist all my life. I come from the left. I'm unequivocally a Chicana. I'm unequivocally a product of Detroit, working class. I mean, I'm not going to say that I'm not influenced by all that has taught me, from liberation theologians to Communist Party members. That's who informed my life and my activism. I'm not going to say that I don't have any thoughts about it one way or the other, but I can say that historically we've seen it before. And if people are not willing to take chances and make great sacrifices, then nothing can be done. But the more we've been standing out here, me and the board members have been blacklisted. We've lost our jobs. We've been made pariahs in our own community. Nobody wants to talk to us publicly because everybody is so worried about Skillman Foundation or the philanthropic foundation seeing that they're talking to us because we're clearly just absolute pariahs. There's seven of us, and we have paid dearly and not been compensated financially. Many of us deal with our utilities being in shutoff, with not being able to help our kids the way that we want to help our kids, the way that we should be able to with the level of education and professionalism that we've achieved. We're blacklisted, and we're broke. And we'll stay broke like this until they come and take us. And when they come and take us, we'll go to jail. And I know that we won't have very much support at that time. It's a very, very difficult time here. People have got to just really bite the bullet and take a chance. What little they have is not worth having when we're giving up so much here. When we're giving up the right to vote, when we're giving up I'm not talking about the right to vote just to go to the polls and vote. I'm talking about the right to vote that decides what the curriculum in the school will be, what schools open and close, the right to vote that makes things fair. That's the meaning of voting, not just voting to say that you can vote. I'm talking about the vote that makes things even and equal in government. If we don't have that right, we don't have anything here. So people just trying to get hooked up and be quiet about things are going to, they know what it's costing us. But this is all,
how
I, can people, all I can do.
How
is
can people help,
appeal.
Elena? How can people help?
People could help by asking the Justice Department to investigate the Detroit Public Schools, for an audit. We asked for a forensic audit of the money. Because only when we show that all this money has been stolen can we be restored. And even if they don't restore us, they can't make us pay a debt that we didn't create. So the first thing is, it demands that the U.S. Justice Department do a forensic audit of Detroit Public Schools and Governor Snyder to show where all the money went. Because everybody's saying Detroit shouldn't be bailed out. I'm saying don't ask where the money's going to come from. Ask where it went. Ask where it went. A forensic audit of the governor's office would really be a good start. Nationally, internationally, everybody should be bearing down on that. And I know it's an atrocity to poison water and children, but it's a long-term death knell to steal education. And that's the part that is so frustrating. It's a very slow death to steal public education from all the black residents of the state of Michigan. Poisoning water really got the attention of white people. It captured the imagination of the country because it's such an incredible violation that everybody identifies with. But so many people do not identify with the issue of public education being stolen. There's all kinds of reasons for that, and I'll write more about that. But I'm telling you, the racialization of this struggle is intense. The water struggle is very, very important, and white people would never have gotten involved in the struggle about the emergency manager until water was poisoned. But we have been crying out for help on public education, and it falls on deaf ears. And as always, the environmental movement is something that's very elite.
I want to thank you so much, Elena, for being with us and always educating us about what's at stake in the city of Detroit. But more so, you and others who are valiantly standing up and resisting. And because of that, I can't help but think that what was intended has not yet gone through 100% because stalwart people like you stood in the way.
We have stopped them. Thank you so much. And ask everybody to contact the Attorney General.
Thank you so much, Elena Arada, for being with us today.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of the program, and I hope on both counts it was instructive. And, you know, the water issue, you may recall we dealt with that months ago here on Lead Stories. It wasn't a big story then, but it certainly is a big story now. We are trying to let you know that things are happening. And they're not they're not just innocently happening or just accidentally happening. There's a purpose and there's a reason. And people may say, well, you're encouraging paranoia. And I say, like I quote Adam Clayton Powell, if you're paranoid, that doesn't necessarily mean you're crazy. Coming up next, the Global Research News Hour. You want to stay tuned. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. And as always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Thanks for joining me. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.